Okay, folks. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the March monthly meeting of the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. Today is March 9th. It is 11 a.m. I'm Robert Spagnoletti, Chair of the Board, and with me today are all five board members in person, so we have a complete quorum. We had an agenda posted in accordance with the Open Meetings Act, and unless there are any changes, folks? No? We'll go ahead and adopt it by consensus and immediately go to the first item on our agenda, which is a report from the Director of Open Government, Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On February 23, 2017, the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability testified before the Committee on the Judiciary and Public Safety. I delivered testimony on behalf of the Office of Open Government, highlighting the accomplishments of the office during fiscal years 2016 and 2017. The specific budget request mentioned during the testimony was for an additional $80,000, to cover anticipated operational costs for fiscal year 2018 and to cover a salary increase for the one legal service FTE assigned to the Office of Open Government. Additionally, there was public testimony offered in support of the office and testimony regarding the draft legislation to be attached to the Budget Support Act. So upon reflection about this legislation, I've asked the chair to please pull the proposed legislation from the Budget Support Act because, as written, it resolves a budgetary problem but does not address the long-term sustainability of this office as it was originally intended as an independent agency. I've therefore determined that the Office of Open Government will take more time to draft legislation that will position the OOG as a fully independent entity, and I'll be fully prepared to address that with the board at our next monthly meeting.
Yeah, just two things while you're on that point. One is that to say that you got support from the community is an understatement, because they think that you and your staff walk on water based on what they talk and how wonderful you have been interacting with everybody. So I want to thank you for all that. And secondly, we had a conversation this morning talking about the BSA. I have shared individually with the other three of the other board members. I didn't get a chance to talk to Ms. Hutchison. But essentially, everyone is in agreement that it makes sense to get the legislation right. And because this piece of legislation is 90% dealing with the Office of Open Government, there's no urgency to it. We want to make sure we get it right. And so we look forward to having your proposal for the April meeting.
You will indeed.
And if I can offer the services of Mr. Grimaldi as you work your way through this, to the extent that he can assist you and your staff, with just the legislative thinking, thoughts, ideas, please, by all means.
Of course. Thank you. Okay. So the full testimony from the hearing is published on the Office of Open Government website. That full video is there if you'd like to see it. Since the last meeting, the OOG has fielded 26 requests for advice. That included 5 technical, 14 FOIA, and 7 Open Meetings Act. We've also conducted 4 Open Meetings Act trainings, and I conducted the first of the Open Meetings Act training specifically designed for the administrative points of contact, as discussed last month. Next week is Sunshine Week. Sunshine Week is a nationwide celebration of public access to government. The OOG will attend an event next week sponsored by the Open Government Coalition at the National Press Club. I'm hopeful that we will know more next week about the revival of the Strengthening Transparency and Access to Open Government Act. So that's the omnibus legislation that would make improvements to FOIA and the Open Meetings Act.
At the end of last session, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that concludes my update.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Any questions? No? All right. So let's move on. Mr. Sobin, the report on the Office of Government Ethics. That'd be great because my stomach is growling. Is your microphone on?
Okay. Director Hughes has already spoken about the oversight hearing. I think we had some good witnesses from all sides, even on the ethics side, which is unusual because we sanctioned so many people. But there was a lobbyist that showed up who has said some nice things about the staff as far as customer service, which has always been important to me. He's actually planning to come back to our budget hearing after I told him about our request to for funding to replace the e-filing system. So I think we'll have some additional support from the lobbyist community, at least through his testimony.
How unusual is that, to have the lobbyists come in support of the group that oversees the lobbyists?
Maybe Director Hughes wants to talk about this too, but we're going to be doing a thing on lobbyists pretty soon at the D.C. Bar. Director Hughes is on the steering committee, and we've been invited.
Right, I saw that invitation. Yeah.
So, yes, the steering committee will be doing a session on lobbyist activity in the district, ethics generally.
Right.
And then part of this, they're going to be focusing on lobbyist rules and regulations, so we've invited the board and then Director Sobin to participate.
That's in April, right?
In April, right. Yes.
Okay. Looking forward to it. All right, just an update on our stats. Investigations opened. The investigations are not coming in at a fast and furious pace like they used to. So we opened up one as opposed to three last month, and that was at one in December. We closed three. Last month we closed four. We closed five in December, so we're really down to only four active investigations right now. Again, we're getting ready for the slew of cases we're hoping that are going to come from our state cases. And so what I did was, Mr. Flowers broke it down for you so you see the nature of the state cases. We have two that are pending in court, and one of those two, the guy's a fugitive, so we're probably not going anywhere with that for a while. The Office of Employee Appeals has one matter we've decided to stay because it's before it, and there are motions pending in that case. But as you can see, the bulk really is from the Office of the Inspector General, 14 that are stayed because they are continuing to investigate, and those are the ones we're really waiting on that we keep hearing are coming soon, but they're not here yet. There is one that OAG has that we've decided to stay because they're pursuing a False Claims Act. On the next page you can see there's three with respect to the council that we've stayed because of the Comprehensive Code of Conduct. As we all agreed, we wanted to see if they would make our make the changes we recommended before we go forward with an enforcement proceeding. And then there's an IRS Office of Tax and Revenue potential criminal complaint that we've decided to step back from because of the criminal nature. Item B, our publication and reporting obligations are in compliance. Item C, trainings and outreach attended by staff, senior attorney Grimaldi attended an ADA self-assessment training presented by the Office of Disability Rights. Mr. Grimaldi, of course, is our ADA coordinator in the office. Because we're such a small agency, everyone gets to be something. So we have an ADA coordinator, we have an EEO coordinator, we have a safety compliance person. I forget who that is at the moment. So everybody's doing their part. Several staff members, including Ms. Dillian and Mr. Dow, attended a training offered by Okto in conjunction with the anticipated migration of OGE's website back to the district servers. Internally, we have weekly meetings on FDS and lobbyists in preparation for what is now the start of FDS filing season. Conducted by staff, we actually were able to get in 15. That's up from 9 last month. The 15 trainings included 3 new employee orientations, an MSS training, 1 general board and commission training, which I appreciate Mr. Flowers doing on a Saturday because I was out of town, training sessions at the Office of Unified Communications, the United Medical Center, the Mayor's Office of Legal Counsel, and the Health Benefit Exchange. We also went to DCPS to provide the new chancellor with a briefing on the district's code of conduct, personalized briefing. Rules that would satisfy the mandatory retraining requirement applicable to all employees who are required to file either public or confidential financial disclosure statements. So he's good.
Good.
Advisory opinions, item D, and advice. We actually went up a bit to 80 this month, and that was up from 61 we responded to last month. We have several formal advisory opinions in the pipeline, including one for an employee with a cupcake business who asked whether she could sell cupcakes to her coworkers, and another on post-employment restrictions. We anticipate having a proposed sua sponte opinion on the applicability of the Code of Conduct to ANC commissioners ready in time for the Attorney General's ANC summit that is scheduled to be held next Saturday. They've invited me to come and speak about it. And so we view this as a good opportunity to sort of ramp up notice
right.
that this is coming.
That is a good idea, because we've spoken about this before to try to give them as much notice as we can.
So if I get out alive, that'll be really the kickoff of their notice. With any luck, they'll bear the brunt on the Attorney General, whose summit it is. All right, item E, ethics legislation and the comprehensive code. As usual, I'm happy to turn it over to our point man on this, Mr. Grimaldi.
Thank you. Oh, now it's on. All right. Yes, since the last board meeting, we did refile the CCC, as we've come to know it, in endearing terms. The strategy kind of shook out. My sense, following a meeting that the chair and Mr. Sobin had with Councilmember Allen, we actually introduced the bill through Chairman Mendelson. We, if you recall, talked about a couple of ways to do it. We figured it was wise to go that route again, as we did back in 2015. One of the main considerations there is we filed what in the council's rules called a substantially similar version of what we filed in 2015, and that's the bill that lapsed at the end of the last council period. But that would save us having to go through another hearing. So what we've done is work with Councilmember Allen's committee director, and she's right on top of things because they're going through budget and performance oversight and stuff like that now. She doesn't anticipate until at least late May to kind of get around to this. So the bottom line to that is that we have time to kind of further tweak, if that's what we want to do, the changes we want to make in the legislation, and then get it to them around that time, I would imagine. In the last email that I got from Kate Mitchell, she said at that point they could kind of pivot back to bills and start thinking about some summer strategies. Now, that's good and bad. We kind of died in the swamp, what was it, last summer, I think. But
that's one way of putting it.
It came to me this morning, for any of you who are into numerology, all right, our new bill is Bill 22-136, okay? Councilmember Nadeau's bill, the one that reflected the BPR recommendations going back to 2014 or something like that, is 22-36. So the numbers are aligned, for whatever that may mean, okay? And you know, maybe this is the year. So in any event, that's the latest on the CCC.
Okay. Well, at least it's moving.
Yes.
And it's back before the council, which is good.
Can I request a hard copy of it so I can add notes as I go through it?
Sure.
Okay. And it can be back in front so we can say paper.
Okay. You can come on up later on. I'll print it out for you. Sure. Sure.
Okay. Well, not much we can do on the legislation side, but there is something we can do on the rulemaking side, which brings us to item F. So the proposed rulemaking, which you approved last month, will be published in the D.C. Register tomorrow. That's the rulemaking that clarifies the fine that will be imposed on FDS filers who failed to file a true, complete, and correct confidential report. So this will enable us to really ramp up enforcement on that end.
Right.
The next item, so this is a little different. So during the course of our training and in response to inquiries from boards and commissions, we've determined now that there are a number of boards and commissions that we believe should be required to file public financial disclosure statements that at the present time, because they're not considered a 2E or 2F board, are not required to. These include those with significant financial and fiduciary responsibilities, such as the DC Retirement Board, the Public Charter School Credit Enhancement Fund Committee, United Medical Center, Public Charter School Board, and the Health Benefit Exchange. The Public Charter School Credit Enhancement Fund Committee, for example, provides millions of dollars in funds to DC public charter schools. But because it is not listed as a what we call a 2E board, its members are not required to file financial disclosure statements.
Which means if they have a connection to any of those charter schools that they're giving money to, we don't know about it.
Right. Now, we have the authority to do this under the Ethics Act because we can add folks to the list of required filers by rulemaking. And so that's the authority we're using. In the CCC, we proposed adding a number of these boards to the agencies whose members were required to file public financial disclosure statements. However, as I said, the Ethics Board has the authority to make this change by exercising its rulemaking authority with respect to designating who are public officials. The term public official means any additional employees designated by rule by the Ethics Board who make decisions or participate substantially in areas of contracting, procurement, administration of grants or subsidies, developing policies, land use planning, inspecting, licensing, regulating, or auditing, or act in areas of responsibility that may create a conflict of interest or appearance of that. And so this requirement to file public statements currently only applies to the 25 or so boards and commissions listed in 2E of the Confirmation Act, but as we know, there are more. So what we're doing is we're compiling a list of those that are currently exempt, but we believe should be required to file given their responsibilities and duties, and we'll present that list to you upon completion.
Yeah, now, and this is important because even that small number that you just list there, every one of them has a significant role in either contracting, procurement, grant administration. I mean, the Health Benefit Exchange, for example.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, any of them, really. DC Retirement Board. And these are areas where, if there are conflicts, the public financial disclosure system is designed to help elucidate them. So,
yep.
No. Big bucks.
Yeah.
Director Sobin.
Yes.
With that list, could you give just a brief sentence as to the duty that could potentially create the conflict as well?
Ryan, what were you thinking when you put this, the amount of money that we're talking about? So when you're talking about contracting, procurement, awarding things, those are the kinds of things that normally would trigger the filing requirement because we want to know before, if you have any kind of authority to award something like a contract or a grant or anything like that, who your outside interests are to make sure that you're not awarding it to them.
Right. I think maybe what Spencer was saying was when you tell us what the boards and commissions are that you're recommending, kind of where what they do, because some of the names.
Yeah, we can do that. We can do
that. Absolutely.
The ones listed are clear, I agree, but right. Some of them may not be so obvious.
We will provide a justification. No worries.
Thank you.
Okay. Moving on to the budget. We have been informed that there is a projected $119,000 shortfall in our personal service funds through the end of the current fiscal year. This is the result of several factors. Two attorneys left the agency in the previous fiscal year, and the two replacements that we hired were more experienced, thus requiring a higher starting salary. Two employees took FMLA, and the agency was required to pay 8 weeks of salary for each of them, while at the same time replacing one of them with temporary assistance to cover essential duties. Three, an existing employee whose job description did not adequately capture the tasks expected of her when she was hired was elevated to a higher salaried position. And four, and this was the big one, because the agency employs five attorneys, all of whom received a 10.75% pay raise under the legal services pay scale at the beginning of the fiscal year, and that pay raise had not been factored into the budget process when the fiscal year 17 budget was approved by the council. So we are addressing this shortfall by submitting a reprogramming request to the mayor that would allow us to use our OTIT funds from fines and lobbyists to make up the difference. This is permissible, and luckily we have it, because the salaries in question can be attributed to lobbyist FDS staff duties for the most part. However, this is far from an ideal solution because since those funds will now not be available to overhaul the e-filing system as we had hoped, making it essential that we receive approval of the capital budget request that we made to the mayor for that very purpose. Any questions about that before we move on? All right. Thank goodness for those O-type funds. It's saved us more than once. Staffing. We are in the process of filling the attorney position vacated by Mr. Chanoon. Also, Attorney Cooks, who's one of the FMLA attorneys I mentioned, is scheduled to return to the office on March 20th, and we are anxiously waiting her return. Other than that, we're doing well. I should mention that Ms. Stuart Mitchell, behind me, has graciously agreed to stay through, at least through June. We had her as a temporary attorney to cover for Ms. Cooks until she got back, but she's now going to stay through June because she's doing such a great job with helping us on the FDS and lobbyist side. She's become essential, and so she's agreed to stay at least until June, and then we'll revisit and see what we can do at that point. So,
great.
Yep. Item I, lobbyist FDS matters. So with respect to public financial disclosure statements, March 1st was the deadline for all agencies, boards, and commissions to submit their list of public financial disclosure filers to our office. This year, we had a record number of agencies comply with that deadline, and we continue to receive public filer lists from agencies that were a little late on a daily basis. The next deadline is May 1st, which is when agencies must submit their lists of confidential filers. Employees must file their confidential and public financial disclosure statements by the May 15th deadline. And on June 1st, all agencies must submit to our office their confidential financial disclosure statement review reports, which list the names of noncompliant filers and any violations that they find when they go over the CFDS forms. Those would be reported to us. I don't want to take too much credit here, but I think everybody's after that BEGA certificate of excellence that we promised if they get their reports to us filed on time. So we're off to a great start. They just have to keep it up.
Hopefully they don't want their names posted in the DC Register as having not complied. I'm not sure whether it's the carrot or the stick that's driving it, but whatever works, works.
Confidential disclosure statement enforcement. Last month, we reported that an audit of the 2016 confidential disclosure statement review reports revealed that approximately 180 employees failed to submit their CFDS forms to their agency head by the May 16th, because last year, 15th was a Sunday, 2016 deadline. We reached out to these non-compliant filers through February and instructed them to immediately file their CFDS with their agency. In response, approximately 73 employees immediately filed their CFDSs with their agency, leaving 107 remaining non-filers. We're working with the agency ethics counselors to bring these remaining employees into compliance. And again, this is all resource-driven. I mean, it took us this long to get to this. We've asked the council now and the mayor for additional resources. And again, that's why I'm very happy that Ms. Stuart Mitchell is staying to continue these efforts.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Is there the ones, the 107 who haven't complied, is there a fine or what's the penalty for not doing that?
You want to address it? Mr. Flowers.
I don't think we've really decided because there's going to be, it's almost going to overlap with the next filing season. That's the problem that we're facing.
And part of the problem is the rulemaking that we're instituting. The way we're looking at it, we're not going to charge them late fees. But if these 107 continue to refuse, we're letting them know it's an intentional refusal to file, and it becomes an enforcement proceeding for which we would issue an NOV. So that's the direction we're going. But at this point, we just want them to file.
Yeah.
Well, I think this discussion may have helped.
I think so.
Okay. Lobbyists. July 2016 lobbyist activity reports, desk review audits at the November and December 2016 board meetings. We noted that we sent inquiry letters to five entities to ascertain their business relationships with the lobbyists that disclosed them as their clients. The office received and reviewed the responses submitted by the five entities and imposed civil penalties on three entities for their failure to register as lobbyists and for their failure to timely file their lobbying activity reports. We are happy to report that all three entities have now registered as lobbyists with the requisite reports and paid their fines and fees, which totaled nearly $2,500. Because we determined that the other two entities did not engage in lobbying, we did not require them to register or file lobbying activity reports, and we did not impose any civil penalties. I don't have any non-confidential investigations of a public nature to discuss with you guys this time. So if you want to move to the executive session, we have some business.
Sure. So at this point, the board typically offers an opportunity for members of the public to address the board on any matters that are appropriately before the board. I don't see anyone in the room, but I understand Mr. Sindrum would like to call in and say a few words. So we're patching him in.
Okay, so the line is busy.
All right.
I think we should just move on.
Okay. So the time is now 11:26, and if I could get a motion to move us to an executive non-public session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Code 2-575B. To deliberate on a decision in which the board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Code 2-575B13 and personnel matters pursuant to DC Code 2-575B10, that would be appreciated. So moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any nays? No. Hearing none, the time is 11:26. We'll close the public session. Go to the confidential non-public session, and then we'll reopen the public session to report on anything further. All right, so the time is 11:50. We're back on the public record, and we don't have anything to report from the closed session that has changed to the public session. So hearing nothing further, we'll go ahead and adjourn until our April meeting, which is April
6th.
April 6th. So everyone, thank you very much, and we will see you then. The time is still 11:50, and we'll go ahead and go off the public record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and board members.
Thank you. We still got to do a lot of stuff. Yeah, that was perfect.